Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Jo Stoll, footballer's wife, no, ex-footballer's wife. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But to start this week, I'm joined by Jo Stoll. She's an ex-WAG. Now, tell us, what does WAG stand for, Jo?
It's just wives and girlfriends. I think it was in the World Cup when they decided that, I think one of the tabloids, that's what they named them when, so it just sort of stuck, really.
So what got you into that world in the first place?
I was in boarding school in Kirkham, Lancashire, and I went to the cash point when you could get £5 out of the cash point.
Oh, yeah, remember that? Those days, yeah.
And my future husband was just signed for Everton. He was just basically playing on the Sunday league and the goalkeeping, and Howard Kendall spotted him and signed him basically on the spot when he was 21 or 22, which never happens. It's never, ever happened.
And, well, when you say on the spot, not by a cash point.
Well, no, he was on the field. Yeah, just right. Playing semi-professional, but then he just suddenly, all of a sudden, was playing for Everton. He was working at Telecom engineer, and then suddenly. And I was at boarding school, and he went to the cash points at that time, and we just started talking. That was like, I was 16. And I left boarding school and got ideas of going to be... I wanted to go to St. Martin's.
Art college,
yeah. Because yeah. I'm a photographer. I ended up running off with a footballer.
But 16 is very young, isn't it?
Well, no, I was 18 by the time I finished my A levels and finished school and packed my things, and that was it. And we were married for 20 years.
Right, but tell us a bit about that world, because it must be almost like being on another planet.
Well, it was just the 19. If we think 1987 onwards to through the 90s,
yeah, I'm thinking through the 1990s. Yeah,
it wasn't big money then. I mean, we were on a lot more money than, say, your average Joe, but it wasn't huge money like it was now. It was I met quite a lot of famous people in the world then. Graham Taylor was our manager and then Steve Ball, and there's a story where Gazza. We were playing Everton, and they had a bet going on to see what's the daftest thing that Gazza could do. And he came out to the toilets and was eating a urinal cake, and that was his bet. He won the bet. That's when he was at his top of his game then. That was when we played Tottenham. It was weird. Remember, the people that you meet when you're in football, and then you think about it now, it's not like it is now, where they really, really are superstars. They were just more talented, I think. There was less foreign players.
I mean, also, I think one of the things that's happened now is money has really become one of the main things in football. So tell us how you think that's changed over the last few decades.
Well, I remember having a conversation with Pat Nevin once, and we were talking about...
Just tell us who Pat is.
Nevin, he was a... I can't remember what he played for. I know he played for Everton with us. I don't know what position he played. I still don't know the offside rule after all these years, and I still don't know. And Pat was telling me that he was saying, don't put your money in pension, like, because all the players were being told to put their money in pensions, and not so much property then, it was more pensions. And he said, no, buy art, lots of art. And he was going to the Saatchi Gallery and just buying up all the, you know, and I think that he's done quite well, you know, from buying art then. And he was much more visionary then. He was quite a different sort of a player than some of the ones that you'd meet. You know, you've met some complete... I could
Is there anybody that really stands out as someone that you felt that as a professional footballer or someone in the world of football stood out as someone a little bit different, you know, and maybe not so much just about the game, but maybe a bit of a deeper character or something? Anyone at all that sticks out in your mind, and, you know, because you must have done a lot of socialising over those years.
Yeah, Pat Vandenhout. He was not in a good way, in a bad way. That he went really in the bad. He was married to Mandy Smith, and she just finished with Bill Wyman, so it was all a bit nuts. I remember him, but not in a good way. In a good way, I think Pat Nevin and Neville Southall was absolutely. He grounded me. He kept me on the ground. He was a bin man before he became a footballer, and whenever I used to whinge about stuff, he used to tell me the story about him being a bin man. He was really nice.
What about the social life then? Was it just sort of, would you go away with the team, weekends,
no.
away games?
No. Oh, it was chauvinist pig, but great. Oh, my word, no, you do. Little wife stays at home, looks after the children, barefoot in the kitchen. I don't know if it's changed at all now, but that's exactly, you know, we didn't have a say in anything. We weren't invited on anything. We didn't.
Did you not think to yourself, hang on, I should be keeping an eye on him?
Well, he was terrible. He made John Terry, my ex-husband, made John Terry look like a saint. I mean, he was in every way.
So you must have thought to yourself, well, hang on a minute, I'm really going to have to keep track on him and actually maybe, you know, go away on an away game or whatever.
No, you couldn't.
You just couldn't do it.
You couldn't. You're not. And it's not. There was a peer pressure as well. If he would be absolutely mullered by the other players if I, you know, did anything or and if whatever they get up to, footballers as well, it's almost like a clan. You know, the Masons have got nothing on that lot. They keep it under the rug. You
almost
know.
A cult, because yeah, I mean the Masons are a religious cult, really, yeah. and it's a bit like that. What about City? What do you think about the way that they've gotten on over the years?
We signed for City, and I went a few times, but I didn't. I knew that my marriage was on the wane, even though it was like 5 years before we got divorced from there. I really didn't take any more interest in football, and thought, well, if it doesn't take any interest in what I want to do and my life, I didn't really go there at all.
What about children?
My children.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're going through a divorce, kids involved.
Yeah, yeah, I got three. Yeah, Charlotte, she's actually been absolutely fantastic. Steve Lansdowne helped with that. He got her a job at Bristol City when she first finished her degree, and then she moved on to Western College and helped, and she started working for them, and now she's at Brunel University teaching she's physio and in London. And
but the divorce must have been difficult for them.
Awful, absolutely horrendous. Kieran was 12, Charlotte was Charlotte was 12, Kieran was 9, and Will was 4. And it was, oh, gosh, it was awful.
Now, there was a sort of legal tussle, wasn't there? So yeah. give us your...
Well, he had an affair with a footballer, a woman footballer that he was supposed to be training, and he left. And that one, you know, people fall out of love all the time, that's fine.
So can I ask you what happened? I mean, how did you find out about that? I mean, I'm sure he didn't just come home and tell you, did he?
Well, I got lots of people sending me notes through the... through, you know, anonymous letters I got, and people were ringing me up and telling me, but until it's confronted, and then he just sort of told me, and that was it, really. So
what happened then?
I didn't know Bristol very well, so but somebody said, oh, there's a fantastic lawyer called James Myatt, and he's a assistant mayor of Bristol, actually, and he's really, and I didn't know anything about him. He has been like my father. He has been absolutely fantastic. He works at Thrings in town now, and he basically, because Mick said to me when we don't have to go to get properly divorced, we can just do it on the internet. And I didn't know any better, because I've been with him since I was 16, so I'm stupid, wasn't I? But I went and got some legal advice, and James was laughing so much he had to pull himself off the floor. And so anyway, we got divorced, but James was absolutely amazing, and from that day onwards he's always given me advice. And the court was very good in Bristol. They're very family oriented, and they they were fantastic. I mean, I had a really good team. And I also was tied into his football pension, which didn't please him. But I wasn't going to take it for a good couple of years because I'm only 45, so I've got plenty of way to go. So about 2 years ago, I got a letter through the door out of the blue from Mick's solicitor called Kevin Harris James, and it was the most, I'll show it you one, oh, I'll email it you through, the most horriblest letter. I don't think, and I've spoke to a lot of lawyers since, and said that it should be banned.
Well, just a minute, I'm just going to put one thing to you here, because surely if you're communicating, the solicitor really should be communicating with your solicitor, not directly with you.
Yeah, he directly sent it to me. It was absolutely horrific. He said that I don't deserve what I got. I'm just grasping wife. After, you know, after 9 years, I get this letter.
Well, then you see, some of that potentially is possibly libelous, isn't it? Even, well, I mean, what he's saying.
He doesn't even met me.
You.
He doesn't even know me. He's just heard what Mick has told him. And
that sounds to me like sharp practice amongst the solicitor. Yeah. If he's actually sending letters directly to you and ignoring your own solicitor, that sounds a bit strange. What happened after that?
Well, he offered me half my maintenance on my son. Because,
hang on, this is after it's all been organised and sorted out and agreed by the court.
Yeah, this is 9 years later. This is just out of the blue. And literally, I fainted and banged my head on the chair going down because he wanted to take half my money from Will, which means that I would have probably had to sell my house. And secondly, he wanted just to give me a nominal fee amount of money for the pension. Well, would you accept something that you didn't even know the full amount from the beginning?
Well, look, I mean, he's within his legal rights, potentially anyway, to challenge the decision made by the court.
Yeah.
But to do it like that, by sending directly a letter to you rather than going through your solicitor, to at least give your solicitor a chance to look at it first.
Yeah.
And possibly reply to him, you know, with a bit of advice from you, that will cushion the blow, and that's a much more professional way to do it.
Yeah, well, no. So I went, rang James straight away, sent it through to James. James was so angry. It was unbelievable. He said, they shouldn't have even contacted me, should have contacted him.
Yeah.
And he said, well, how can we? So we need to know your full disclosure of what you're on now and everything. And he's just about to sign Leicester City, just going up to the Premiership. So anyway, for 2 years, he dragged this out. I couldn't claim for legal aid, even though I don't earn enough. I still got my son to look after. And the way that it was before, I could have claimed for legal aid. Now I couldn't get legal aid.
Well, are you talking about the recent changes to legal aid about 3 years ago?
Yeah, well,
good old Ken Clark and his wonderful Tory reforms.
Wonderful.
Taking away legal aid from people that really need it.
Yeah. So basically, I'm not going to talk figures, but he offered me a nominal amount. I accept that or I go to court myself and do it myself and try and win it through myself. Well, my ex-husband has one of the top lawyers who works for OK Magazine. He works for all the celebrities. He's called Kevin Harris James. And also, Mick was getting all his advice free. And this man as well frightened the living daylights out of me. So the thought of having to him, and then he was going to get a barrister and everything. So luckily, I had friends, family, and borrowed, and Mark helped me. We had to go and get a loan. And we got used Daniel Leaf, who was an amazing barrister, and managed to get all sorted. But to make, he kept stalling and stalling and stalling, kept stalling it. It took 2 years at the cost of £75,000 in the end, which I have to pay, even though the court has already awarded it to me. It's not, none of this is my fault. I wasn't, you know, I'm just carrying on with my life and everything. Then, so what if the judge says that you can have this, Mick says no, then I have to go to court because he says no. Does that make any sense? I don't understand why I have to bear the brunt of it. So basically, I had to go to court the third time. And then he settles right at the end of the court hearing, just before we have to go into the court. And
oh, sorry, hang on. So that's an out-of-court settlement.
Yeah.
So the idea really is this whole thing is to try and get you into court to intimidate. And if, in fact, one of the things that you find quite often, for example, with these international accusations and prosecutions of the banks is that they'll prosecute the banks and then they'll say at the last minute, oh, an out-of-court settlement. But the idea is a sort of way to intimidate. Yeah. So perhaps it would have been better if you'd have gone to court. You may have even got more.
Well, we weighed that up, but actually I would have got more, but I would have. But my ex-husband would have had to pay me for my, well, for me forever. Basically, the judge would have for the, because he can't just wash his hands of, even though he's divorced and everything like that, because of the original agreement. But I worked it out that I think that I'm better off with my pension and having a pension than actually having more maintenance for my son. But then my son's going to grow older and I'm not going to have as, I'd rather have more pension than more maintenance.
So what advice do you think you've got for anyone listening that might...
I'm saying, do not, and this is to men and women, do not just accept what they tell you, and please look at what they have in their pensions, because you can, even 9 years later, please go after the pensions as well, because it's your entitlement. I was with him for 16, when I was the age of 16, and I deserve that. I mean, the life that he put me through, anybody else would, because I was married to him, abuse, I think, doesn't apply to a wife. And I felt very strongly about, you know, because I could have had him arrested many times, because, well, basically, he gets away with it because we're married.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Well, yes, it does to a certain extent. But I mean, I think that this is the sort of advice that's very handy to have.
Yeah.
Because people, you just do not know when something like this is going to happen.
And they strike as well. When you're so down, you're thinking, oh, my life's fallen apart and everything. Then they think, oh, well, I just have the house. And they'll just, and then they'll walk away. And then you, later on, in about 9 years' time, you'll see he has pension. If I had not got that loan and gone to and got a barrister, I'll tell you now, honestly, I would have lost £160,000 in pension.
Amazing. But I mean, I'll give you an example, something from my past. Mm. I was in the centre of Bristol here with a Tesco lorry, actually ran into the back of me, right? I was stationary, Tesco lorry went into the back of my car. I tried to get my insurance company to basically fight them, and it was this company called Zurich Insurance, and their lawyers are apparently the best in the world, the highest paid, some Swiss people, right? Mm. And they managed to twist it so that somehow I was responsible, yeah? And this, so what we're dealing with now, we're dealing with a litigant kind of culture, which is almost kind of imported from America, where if you can pay lawyers a fantastic amount of money, like ridiculous amounts, then they can get anything for you, they can twist the law in their favour. And especially with the taking away of a lot of legal aid, is it means that the people who don't have big wadges of cash to throw at lawyers basically often lose.
I don't
lose.
Have it, though. I've had to beg, borrow and steal. I'm in debt now.
Steal? Excuse me.
Steal off my boyfriend. I had to because... But I'm telling you now that if you don't do that, you're stuffed. Mm. You are literally stuffed.
Well, look, Jo, well done for fighting it through, because it must have been a pretty awful experience.
I want everybody to try, though. I mean, they really must try.
Can people get in touch with you maybe through Twitter or something if they want a bit of advice?
Yeah, definitely.
Because I know you're quite a Twitterer.
I am.
Anyway,
yes.
Look, tell us a bit about your photography, and how did you get into that?
Well, I was sick to death of seeing people being photoshopped, and you know, it's this culture at the moment where it's a self-loathing culture. So you can't take a picture of yourself and like yourself because you're not thin, or you're not this, or you haven't old and whatever. And I just thought, what is wrong with people as they are? And I just had a brainwave. You know, I've always been a photographer. I've always taken photographs, but I I'd take a photograph of the crowd rather than take a picture of him, so he would never understand why I was taking a picture of the crowd. But the reason I was taking the picture of the crowd is because of the energy that was coming from the crowd, the emotion, the raw, proper human, you know. This is much more interesting.
It's almost like a religion, football, isn't it? It's almost like one of those kind of weird... If something happens when you get all those people together.
Oh, I know. They just...
But can you capture it with a camera?
Oh, yes. Well, the first biggest job I got was working at Notts County Football Club for a guy called Peter Trembling. You might have heard of him. And Sven-Goran Eriksson. And Sven invited me to go and work. So I worked there for... And it's my ethos. It's your paparazzi, and it's a day in the life of you. It just doesn't matter what you're doing. You could be asleep, or you could be getting married. I'll photograph you as I see you that day.
It's almost like a portrait. Really,
I'm a stalker.
Isn't it,
right? I'm basically.
Don't say that.
No, I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, I photograph you as I.
So you're quite interested in the legalities, I imagine, of what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do as a photographer, because there's quite a lot of difference between public space and private space.
Well, I mean, in this country, it's fabulous to be a photographer in this country, and until they change the law of Fluella Benjamin, but in America it's completely different. Mm. But
you've got a lot of rights as a photographer.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, you can. And the thing is, public spaces and private spaces, you can go. The street photographers, if you change the law, they'll be dead. And
well,
in the
there's
water,
also quite a lot of attempts by people like Bristol City Council to charge people for filming in public spaces like parks and things like that. There's something wrong with that. Yeah, well, it's a bit naughty, isn't it? Really?
No, it's more than naughty. That's just you know, basically just trying to. It's like the parking meters, and you can't even park outside your own house now without a little thing to say that you live there, and it's all getting too controlled.
And all this stuff to do with the parking, I mean, yes, there's a problem with the parking, but it seems like what's happened is someone has said, well, actually, look, we can tax this.
Yes.
We'll make quite a lot of money out of taxing it too. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, paparazzi, why do you think of yourself as a paparazzo?
Well, that's just the name, actually. I am a stalker. I will follow you around. I've just done a huge big wedding in Milan.
Isn't that illegal?
No. It's a stalking if they don't know who I am. So I'm just following you around. And I take photographs of when you take a picture of your children. You can look at it and go, "Oh yeah, I remember them doing that." That's, you can understand why they've taken that, why their face is like this, or why their expression's like this, rather than being photoshopped to death and sat in front of a white gallery pretending. I mean, I don't understand these boxes that are white boxes and people got jeans on and no top or a white top, and they're all jumping around pretending to be something from a Calvin Klein advert. But Calvin Klein are trying to sell you something. You should be trying to sell. This is about, and they Photoshop you as well. I don't understand this obsession with.
Don't you use Photoshop or?
No, I
like
just
that?
Contrast a little bit of contrast. That's it. My camera is. Basically, extension of my eye and how I see.
And what
the world.
What camera do you use when we get 5D. Too technical? What
I've got all 5Ds.
Is it digital, or you don't use the old-fashioned film? That sort
no,
of thing,
no, no. I can't. I would love to, but I can't because people want the stuff like straight away. I mean, you can download it, put it straight onto a disc, and send it. You can't do that when you've got
no
albums. But
who have you photographed?
Sven Goran Eriksson. I've just photographed the film producer Warwick Ross. He lives in Australia, and I do. I've got quite a lot of clients. I'm not going to say who they are because some of them don't want me to say who they are. But it helps when you're in that football world. But I will photograph anybody and everybody.
What is it about photography that really caught you? What, you know, is anything particular that you think, wow, I've just got to do this?
I love humanity, and I think that's why I'm so prolific on Twitter, because it's been completely and utterly ruined. We're being completely and utterly controlled. And
well, so you're very political. Do you think that you got that, picked up that from, where did you pick it up from?
I was, when I was a kid growing up, one of my mentors was a guy called David James, who is a chemist. He's dead now. He's a chemist he invented the first ever weed killer, and he was a friend of the family, and he made a box brownie, and he always taught me how to see. And basically you see things that other people miss completely, and they're such, and if you get that feeling of, don't even have a camera, but if you get a feeling, that's a fantastic shot, even if you haven't got a camera, that means you can see, is there's ways of seeing, and he taught me ways of seeing. And I remember one time, it was about 1975, and the radio was blowing, Radio 4, and it was talking about the Cold War, and And I said, oh, I hate the Russians, because I've just come from listening to the BBC on and watching the TV, and then I'd heard my parents talking or whatever, and he just shouted at me and said, you don't know any Russians, don't you talk? And he really told me off. And then he told me about when he was in the war and he wouldn't fight in the war, and they threw him in jail, and he had to spend the whole, he was said that he was totally against the concept of it. And then he went to Russia and he spent a lot of time in Joachim Philby, and he is an amazing and he was my mentor.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, this is the Cambridge spies that you were mentored
well
by.
You see, his son, he had three sons. One of them is head of IBM, the other one's head of Philips, and the one was the youngest Don in Oxford. He was a very, very clever family. And when you're taught by somebody like that, and his work, his photography was just, every time he took a photograph of me and he went to dark room, brought it out, showed it to us, it was me. It was like somebody had taken a photo. It was he got the essence of me.
So you were bitten by the photographic bug at
a
really early age.
Oh, my, well, four, something like that. And even though when I was a wag, I didn't even hardly pick up a camera because I always was photographing throughout the crowd. I was photographing, I must have photographed you now, us three, you know, in my head about 60 times already.
Okay, well, look. Tell us about your politics a little bit then. Have you got anything to share with us about that? I'm sure you're doing quite a lot of that on Twitter. But how do you see politics nowadays? Because, I mean, certainly most people look at it, particularly with the mainstream media too, as going in some quite dark directions.
Horrendous.
And not really addressing a lot of the things. I mean, for example, we've got massive inequality now, a great gulf opening up between the super rich and the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I've given you a few things to go with there. Well, what are your thoughts on modern politics?
Well, first of all, your media. I don't care about the politicians myself. I just think they are basically they're just puppets. They're basically like a Fallon, Michael Fallon. You see him today. He was talking about Trident, and that he turned around and he said that shower over there. That's how he talked about the Labour Party. That shower over there. You see, all he's doing is a Tory mouthpiece. Then as soon as he finishes,
I mean, it doesn't matter, does it? Because actually, we elected them.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, there should be a certain amount of respect for people who have said. You know, if so many thousands of people once every 5 years have said, actually, we want that person to represent us.
Yeah.
Yes, well, there's a lot of mess in politics, but there's no need to be disrespectful as well.
I think that this is what I'm saying with the politics in this country. But you see, Michael Fallon, all he's doing is a Tory. A robot could do his job. All he has to do is they have to write down, like the Tory cabinet, write down, put it in, and then he just spouts it out. And then he'll just go and work in some corporation in America for thousands until he dies. That I don't care. What I care about is the media in this country. I am sick to death of our Dan Hodges and fall out with all of them on Twitter because they just put the Tory line. I've even spoken to Finkelstein. He's interested in them about me having to pay legal aid and why did I have to pay it myself. He's very interested in that. And I've done a lot of emails talking to him through it.
I think in the Times.
Yeah. But you see, even he is the Tory line straight away. Nick Robinson, he's a young conservative.
He was the former head of the Young Conservatives.
Young Conservatives, and now they've just deleted it. They've just deleted it out of the BBC thing. Now
they've taken
his BBC profile. They've taken it out of that now because he has to be. And what Murdoch wrote the other day about Muslims, I tell you now that if a Muslim had written that about, say...
So, what are we talking about here exactly? What did he say?
He said that, well, it was basically all Muslims are to blame for the Paris attacks. All Muslims. I mean, how on earth, how dare he talk about 1.6 billion people?
So nobody has told Rupert Murdoch that an Operation Cyclone, where the Americans spent £4 billion in Afghanistan, was the beginning of the radical Muslim jihadi campaign. And that was started by our taxpayers' money.
Yes.
And black budgets as well, from drug dealing by the intelligence services. You know, so yes, there's all sorts.
I was brought up in Bahrain. I lived in Bahrain, and I lived next door to a Shia village. We had big wall in the Shia village, and I used to spend a lot of time climbing over that and going and getting some leavened bread from the, you know, from there. And they were the kindest, loveliest people. We lived in Bahrain when In 1980 when Israel went in and completely obliterated Lebanon, and we had Lebanese Palestinians all flooded in, and the stories they told us, they had keys. That's the one thing I remember. They have these big keys, a lot of Palestinians, from their homes that they were turfed out of. They're still keeping them. They still hold on to them. They showed me their keys. They're absolutely... The way they've been treated is absolutely diabolical.
That's interesting, because, I mean, you know, we hear about the Israelis' right of return after hundreds of years to the Holy Land, but then what about these Palestinians with their keys?
God was not a state agent, was he? And the Bible was not deeds. And at the end of the day, if you're going to go on that route, then we're all Normans. I mean, Normans, I mean, they could come over here, couldn't they, and turf us out of our land.
So at one point in the future, the Palestinians are going to wave their keys and say, now it's our right to return?
If the Americans left the Israelis to fight their own battles, I think you'd see it would be completely different. But actually, America is just a big Israel, so I don't think that's going to happen. But there's one thing that will happen, is that we, as human beings, ingrained in us, no matter what you think about whose side you're on, we know right from wrong. And there's only so much you can take. There's only
even children do, don't they?
There's only so much you can take when you see, you know, a sniper shoot the back of a Palestinian kid's head off. The tide is turning, and you can't. Why is it one rule for Israeli Jews and one rule for the rest of the world? You know, my sister works in a Jewish nursing home. She gets insulted and racist, and there's extremism and there's racism in every single culture, in every single religion. So
do you find that when you go on the internet and put these views, you get
My god, Mark's pulled my phone out of the wall, because I've been getting and it's the North London and Manchester football club football fans that are pro-Israel that are the ones that think that I'm an anti-Semite, but I'm not an anti-Semite.
Well, let's just use that term for a minute, because the Semitic languages are like Aramaic. They are the indigenous Middle Eastern languages. Mm. And actually many modern Jews are from Eastern Europe, not from that part of the world. So it's funny, isn't it? But so they use this term. Actually, Semitic really does mean... It means most of the Middle Eastern Arabic, including some of the Arabic cultures, which is a very strange term. But I know what people mean when they say that.
I'm anti-Zionist. I'm anti-Zionist. I do not like the design. And I'm allowed to say that. You know, David Cameron says, I am a Zionist. He comes out and says, I'm a Zionist. Now, if he came out and said, I'm a Druid, which is this political thing, if he came out and said that, we'd all go, oh, we've got to have a debate in the House of Commons. Quick, everybody get, right, he's a Druid. Oh, what does that mean? But no, he's allowed to say, I'm a committed Zionist. But 95% of the people in this country do not know what Zionism means
entails. Tell us.
Zionism means you have the right to return to Israel, basically. That's the but there's Christian Zionism as well. You know, you've heard about, you know, the end times and the rapture and how God's going to come down and kill us all. It's fundamentalism in each way.
Sorry, I thought it was the devil that was going to do the killing.
Oh, is it the devil? One of them. they make it up as they go along.
The Christian Zionists, I think, are pretty scary in a way, because I think anybody that buys into this idea that is this a kind of fundamentalism, which is rather more scary than the Muslim.
It is completely and utterly engulfed. It's like an octopus that's gone over the American politics. And Ted Cruz, look at Michelle Bachmann. You must see where she stands up and shouts that Moses is the, you know, we're all... It's absolutely... I mean, just like...
There's not a lot of love in it, is there? This is the thing I notice. Isn't that quite important in any kind of faith, I would have thought?
I think that faith should be your own personal belief. And what you mean, people say to me, oh, you're an atheist. I say, well, that's a belief. I believe that atheism is a belief. You know, you believe in atheism, so you're a believer. So basically, you know, I just think, for me, I just die, go into the earth and come up as mulch, and then another person, you know, that's how I see it. I don't need anybody to lean on or crutch, but some people do. I totally get that. But you don't have to put your views and make foreign policy around it.
No, definitely not.
And we are.
Yes, we are,
because you can see it. You know, I look at Hamas and I think it's horrific, the things that, you know, you're almost barbaric in some of the things.
Isn't it weird how Britain created the State of Israel? Because it was actually us that started. Well, there's a terrorist campaign by the initial people in the Israeli state, the Stern Gang, people like that, basically Israeli Jewish terrorists against Britain. We created Israel because we got out of the way and we said, "Okay, off you go, guys. Yeah. You can have your own state there." And we also created America. Mm. So we've got like two poison children that England,
we should mind our own business, actually. I think that we are this white privileged, you know, British Empire, the Raj, and you can see it in MPs like Gerald Howarth and people like that. They drive me insane. You know, the other one, Hollabone. I mean, if Darwin had met Hollabone, that would never have been the origin of the species. He wouldn't need to have written it because, you know, the guy is there. And
But don't you ever think, well, hang on, it's just a mess and I'm going to forget about it, walk away from it? That's what most people do, isn't
it? No, because the thing is, I've got three children and they're going to have children and they're going to have children and they're going to have children, and I do not want... If I can, my last breath in this world is to say, you know, I'm not anti anybody, you know, I don't care what your beliefs are, but I do care that you think that your blood is different to another person's blood just because you think God said something 2,000 years ago,
It's worth remembering that Jesus was really quite big on this, wasn't he? He said, well, hang on a minute, it's not just about the Jews. Yeah. This message is for the Gentiles, for everyone. And I think all of the major figures in those Abrahamic religions are pretty much the same, you know. So,
well, Muhammad turned the other cheek. Muhammad turned the other cheek at all those things. And to be actually honest, you know, if a Muslim does something bad to somebody, then they do bad to they're completely and utterly, you know, it's the worst sin they could commit.
So would you go so far as to say what's going on now with the Muslims is a bit similar to the Nazis and the Jews in the 1930s?
All the people that went for the Charlie Hebdo second edition insult that came out, they are closet racists. To me, they're closet racists. Basically, they're the only reason that they are getting this this magazine is because they go, because they can be racist with impunity now.
Well, it's interesting that almost none of the British newspapers reprinted those. Mm. They were saying, well, yes, we're standing in solidarity with the murdered journalists, but no, we're not reprinting.
Though they're not being seen. Standard journalists, 17 were killed in Palestine. 17, where were they then? Where was the solidarity then?
Well, that's because it's on the streets of Paris, and that's a little bit closer to home.
No, it's because one's got brown skin and one's got white skin.
Well, maybe, Joe. Anyway, how do listeners follow you on Twitter? Because I think that's probably the best way to keep in touch with what you're up to.
It's Joe at Your Paparazzi.
So that's at?
Yeah,
Joe. As at J-O?
J-O at Your Paparazzi.
And you're easy enough to find, are you?
Yeah.
Anyway, Joe, thanks ever so much for coming and sharing with us today on Dialect.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, as you may know, last year, 2014, was the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War. As such, many establishments commemorated it. And now Dialect's Tom Dearnley is going to talk to Karen MacDonald of the M-Shed here in Bristol about an exhibition that's held there until the 1st of March. It's called Moved by Conflict.
Your exhibition runs until the 1st of March next year. Would you tell me a little about it, please?
And it's called Moved by Conflict. It's the story of Bristol and the First World War told through the lives and the words and the images and the objects of people from Bristol or who were in Bristol during the First World War, and also some more contemporary stories of people who live in the city today who were affected by conflict. And we started out with the exhibition wanting to look at how the First World War affected Bristol and its people. So the cultural shifts that happened, the social changes, the personal effects on people's lives that happened as a result of the war, and also how the city itself changed. So there were changes that happened to its industry and its infrastructure. The city looked different, it felt different. There were different people here as a result of the war, and those were the things that we wanted to explore through the exhibition.
You received help from the Old Vic.
Yes, that's right. We actually worked in partnership with Bristol Art Vic to develop the exhibition. It was something that we decided quite early on that we wanted to do, was to bring a different sort of creative approach to the exhibition. Very sensitive subject matter about war, and we wanted to bring in contemporary stories of war, and also to tell these stories that are very personal and very approachable for people from 100 years ago. So we think about how can we do that? And one of the ways that we do it as a museum is obviously through exhibiting objects. And those can be very powerful, and objects that have been personally created or owned by somebody have their own sort of history embedded in them. But there's also a much wider context, and we were thinking about how we might tell the stories that it's difficult to tell through objects alone. And we decided to work with Bristol Old Vic. We approached them because they are a fantastic theatre company. They have a very creative, very innovative approach to theatre. And so we discussed with them how we might go about it, and decided that, or they decided to appoint independent director, who's one of their associates, Melly Still, who has worked on Corum Boy and various other extremely high profile projects. We were really privileged to work with Melly. She has a very sensitive approach to the material, took it very, very seriously. She did a tremendous amount of research, and she created these six fictional characters that people can follow around the exhibition, which sort of marry fact and fiction. So they themselves never existed, and they have their own fictional backstory, but almost everything that they talk about really did happen. So they meet real historical Bristol characters. And they also talk about the wider context of the First World War, the international context that is a bit more difficult for us to tell through the very Bristol-focused objects and archives that we have.
I thought that these stories were particularly interesting. Is it important to have this local connection?
Yes, definitely, and it's absolutely vital for M-Shed in particular, because M-Shed is the Museum of Bristol, and the whole reason that the museum exists is to tell the story of Bristol and Bristol's people. So that was one of the reasons that we wanted our exhibition about the First World War to focus very much on the local. And also because we did have really interesting things in our collections, and actually a lot more than we realised we had at the beginning. Bristol Records Office is a fantastic resource, and there are so many really powerful emotive images and documents through the process of the research that we've been able to include in the exhibition. So there's letters between fathers and their children when the fathers were fighting at the front, and these incredibly poignant postcards that their children were sent back to them. There's business contracts that detail what was coming in and out of the city, the stuff that was being shipped through, the supplies from Fry's Chocolate and Will's Tobacco to the soldiers at the front. And there are loads and loads of extremely emotive, sort of resonant images of things like people working in munitions factories.
Bristol is a very diverse city. Was this central to your exhibition?
Yeah, we did very much want to really reflect diversity, and I think we have managed to do that in some ways, particularly in the contemporary stories that you can find in the exhibition, where we've spoken to people who have come to Bristol as refugees from various different parts of the world. We've included digital stories that the Adult Community Education Department of the Council ran, and where people have created their own films explaining how their story of how they came to be in Bristol as a result of conflict elsewhere in the world more recently. There were also lots of interesting stories about troops from the Empire, the British Empire, the Dominions, and people who came through Bristol. One example of that is, if you visit the exhibition, you'll see that there's a ledger stone we've borrowed from our Argos Vale Cemetery, which has a number of names on it, but two of them are South African soldiers. There was one who was a white South African soldier, one who was a black South African soldier, and they were buried in the same plot, which in their own country at that time would never have happened.
Some people see the Remembrance Ideal as a glorification of war. How did you deal with this issue?
that was something that we were very aware of and did very much want to avoid, or rather we wanted to present a very balanced picture, and I think that's an important role that museums have, actually, is to present a balanced picture and to allow lots of voices and opinions to come through, which is what we try to do. And I think by having stories, real life stories and fictional stories about people who objected to the war, that's one of the ways that we've done it, and it reflects the fact that 100 years ago there were people who, very much like many today, did not want to do anything that supported the cause of war, including in some cases doing auxiliary work, nursing and so on, which some people accepted doing as an alternative, but others felt like that if they were doing that they were freeing somebody else up to fight, so they did not want to. So we have tried to reflect that diversity of opinion, and we've also talked about the negative impacts of war and the results of the things that happened with the city afterwards. In some ways it benefited business-wise. Bristol industries benefited from the war, and in some ways women were able to take on greater, more responsible roles in society and in the workplace. But it wasn't a linear path. There were issues afterwards with women being sacked from their posts to make way for men who were coming back from the fighting.
So this exhibition tries to show the development of Bristol.
I guess so, in a way. I mean, we try to show in the exhibition partly how Bristol has become the city it is today as a result of the First World War, but also how conflict is still shaping the city today, in terms of its demographic and the lives of individuals who have been affected by more recent wars. There was a point in the development of the exhibition at which we had planned to try and cover a full 100 years of conflict. We realised that we were never going to be able to do that justice in the exhibition, so there isn't a huge amount of detail, say, about the Second World War, or more recent wars in the last few decades, but we have tried to show the continuing impact. There's a globe that appears at the end of the exhibition, which marks with a little explosion symbol every war or conflict that's happened since the end of the First World War, which of course was intended to be the war to end all wars, and clearly wasn't, and it's still going on today. So yes, that's been a really important thing to reflect.
Is it felt that remembrance is more important now?
I do think it's important. I think that's something that is being recognised nationally and internationally, and that's why there's such a huge programme of activity going on to commemorate the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War, because there is a recognition that it continued to shape the world that we live in today. So yes, I think right from the very local scale to the global scale, it is an important thing to be doing.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Tom Dernley talking to Karen McDonald at the M Shed about the exhibition entitled Moved by Conflict, which aims to show how conflict in general and World War One in particular affected Bristol and its people. And apologies for the sound quality of that.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's Jeff Sparks with the weekly What's On Guide.
Tony, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Saturday, 31st of January, the Who tribute Quadrophenia will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Judge Dredd. He was an English reggae and ska musician, and in his career and after his death, 13 albums were released in total and also numerous singles. This is from the album Big Hits and is the song Big Five.
Rita, Marenge. There was an old sailor who sat on a rock, a waving and shaking his big hairy fist at the ladies next door in the Ritz. Taught all the children to play with their ice creams and marbles and all things galore. Along comes a lady who looks like a decent young woman who walks like a duck. She said she's invented a new way to ring up the children to sew and to knit. The boys in the stable are shoveling litter and paper from yesterday's hunt. And old Dirty Dread is having some cake in the parlour and singing this song. If you think it's dirty, you're bloody well wrong. Suzanne was a nice girl with plenty of class, who turned the boy's head when she wiggled her eyes at the young boys, as girls sometimes do. To make it quite plain, she was ready to go for a walk or a stroll in the grass, then hurry back home for a nice piece of chicken and ice cream and lots of roast duck. And after this meal, a sizable roll of big bills and a pretty good front. And if he talked softly, she'd show him her little pet dog who is subject to fits, and maybe let him grab a hold of her little white hand with a movement so quick. Then she would lean over and tickle his chin while she showed what she once learned in France, and asked a poor chap to take up his underpants while she sang of the wild eastern shore. Or whatever she wasn't a bad girl really, this Susan. I've had better. Mind you know, she wasn't that bad.
That was Judge Dredd with the song Big Five from the album Big Hits. Also on 31st of January, it's the Outsider 2015 launch party featuring the Skimmity Hitchers, the Feminists, Will Tun and the Wasters, and I Destroy at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 1st of February, Julian Cope will be performing with support at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £22.15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That was all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, WAG, Joe Stowell, that's Wives and Girlfriends, and she's online on Twitter at Joe Your Paparazzi, that's J-O-Y-O-U-R. P-A-P-A-R-A-Z-Z-I, Joe Your Paparazzi. And also thanks to Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol, broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same card next week. Goodbye for now.